Hello, I'm Scott Winstead, FMI Consulting President. As we close out 2025, I want to take a moment to thank you for making this our most listened to year yet on FMI's Built-In podcast. Month after month, leaders across the built environment tuned in for candid conversations about growth, resiliency, and what it takes to build an enduring firm. We've welcomed leaders from every corner of the built environment, CEOs, strategists, and innovators who shared candid insights about what it really takes to build a resilient and enduring firm. And one of the clips that struck a chord with listeners this year came from my conversation with Rob Fallow, CEO of Fortis Construction, when we dug into the idea of cultural drift and what happens when you stop paying attention. His perspective on intentional culture building really hit home for so many of you.
I honestly think that at the heart of it, it has to be the focus, not an afterthought. And it can't be something that's done periodically or done a few times a year. It's got to be a focus every single week. And it certainly is here. If it's not, if you take a break from culture, you know, if you have other priorities that seem to rise to the top, that's when we believe you see drift. And that is something that we have really focused on intently is how do we recognize drift early and correct it so we don't get away from our culture? And that can't be done by just one or two people. It has to be something that's pervasive throughout our organization. And so that is something that we focus on significantly is how do we recognize drift? How do we control it? How do we nudge back into the lanes when we need to? So again, it's all about focus and it's all about priorities. And we believe that that focus on culture is ultimately going to produce the results that we want in the end, not the other way around.
I can't remember where I read this, but I read something not that long ago that said, you know, treat the soft stuff as the hard stuff.
Yeah.
And I think this is certainly an example of that. But you just mentioned the word drift. And in one of our earlier conversations, you mentioned two concepts that are related. There's cultural drift and there's operational drift. I'd love it if you would maybe define those terms in terms of how you all think about them and then how do you guard against them?
Sure. So yeah, we do look at drift in kind of two different areas, cultural and operational. And you know, I think it's important that there is a focus on this again. And you know, when you think about drift, we think about it as a car barreling down the freeway, clearly drifting too far off. You don't want to end up in the ditch. And so as we look at cultural drift, we really define that as straying away from our focus on culture and the importance of culture. And you know, so how do we pulse that? We look at that in several different ways. We look at cultural drift and with markers like internal surveys that we do with our employees. We look at that in terms of observations that our leaders have every day as they're leading their teams. We look at that as, you know, even as simple as words that are used, whether words that are being spoken or words that are being written. For example, hearing too many I's instead of we's, that's cultural drift. Using the term boss is cultural drift at Fortis. Not showing up with humility is cultural drift at Fortis. And so those are all signs. And to some degree, those are the easy signs to see. And if we recognize them quickly, we can nudge them back into the lane without having the car go in the ditch. You know, that's our philosophy, that seeing those early, having the easy conversations to correct those early, really solves for having to make a major course correction if you don't address those early.
Construction is ultimately a people business. Long-term success hinges on having the right leaders in place, people who can lead, execute, and deliver today while developing others for tomorrow. In our latest episode, I had the privilege of speaking with Stina Chandler, who leads our leadership and organizational development practice at FMI, about how aligning enterprise strategy and talent strategy creates the clarity organizations desperately need. We opened the conversation by connecting the dots between talent strategy and enterprise risk.
So every executive knows what's inside their strategic plan. There's something likely related to revenue growth, to growth in new markets, to growth in geographies. And there's a lot of consideration usually for what is what capital needs to be invested to move those growth initiatives forward. And the people side of things often becomes an afterthought. So the idea here would be that strategy certainly comes first, as it should, but rather than the people components being more putting a name in a box under a geography, you're asking yourself, is this person truly ready? So I'm going to get to your enterprise risk question here in just a second. And I have an example to share, actually, of a client that I'm working with right now who put a very bright project executive into a position to run a $1 billion job. And they were probably one rep or two too early. And as a result, made a couple of critical decisions that caused millions in rework and then strained the relationship that was years long with this client. So I think that's the point I'm trying to make around enterprise risk, is that weak pipelines will make good people into unintentional liabilities. And so what I'll often talk to clients about is, it's like you're driving a race car on bald tires. It looks pretty, it's fast, it's going to make those turns quickly, but at some point your tire is going to blow out. And so how do we get ahead of that? And I'm consistently reminded of our research a couple of years ago in the talent study, which was that I think they said of 93, 95% of executives struggle to retain and attract great talent. And more than half of them believe that has significant and severe implications on their profitability. So when you talk about the talent as it relates to enterprise risk, I don't know how you get closer than that sort of impact on your P&L. So when we talk about talent strategy as a way to mitigate that risk, I'm suggesting we get more ahead of that. And rather than saying, ah, oh, we'll just recruit for that role, or we'll just initiate a training to solve that problem, because that's more of band-aids on a systemic issue, right? We need to get ahead of that. And I think I'm not saying anything that a lot of executives wouldn't already know. They know the work that needs to be done in many cases. The challenge is it will take time and it's really hard work. But like Jerry Seinfeld says, the hard way is the right way.
Managing growth in a way that truly aligns with your strategy is no small task. When I talked with Ed Kutsky, Executive Vice President of Aldridge Electric, he emphasized the importance of hiring passionate people and grounding them in a clear, intentional growth strategy. I know you spend a lot of your time both in helping develop and codify the firm's growth strategy and also from an outbound external business development type of a role. So maybe talk a bit about how you approach growth strategy and what goes through your mind when you're thinking about where the firm needs to place its bets.
Yeah, it's a collaborative effort, with the leadership team. We're a pretty diverse company, as you mentioned, in terms of our transportation and power offerings. The other part of our business is we've always been strategic planners, and Ken Aldridge always emphasized strategic growth. And I think one of the things we did on strategic growth is we continued to evolve, and realizing that we couldn't stay the same, couldn't do the same installations, we couldn't do the same projects. We had to continue to evolve, take on more risk, take on more complex projects. And again, that gave us opportunity to grow the company, which gave us opportunity to hire people that kind of fit that mold. So our growth strategy has always been to evolve, right? To do things better, do things differently, understand the needs of our customers and be innovative in the way we approach the work. So as you take on more risk, the field shrinks a little bit in terms of your competition. And if you're able to manage the risk, it's contracting 101, right? Manage the risk, and then you can achieve some profitability. But it's a tight business, and it always has been, right? High risk, low return business. But continuing to evolve, I think, has probably been our strategy. So we look at trying to match our core values to the markets that we pursue. So we have what's called a strategic approach at Aldridge, which is made up of the value drivers we bring to the market, the type of markets we serve, the programs we'd like to get involved in, and then our internal support systems that provide us the ability to go execute. And we always try to match up the strategic approach for Aldridge to the markets that we're pursuing. So not only are we looking at a market based on its geography, its longevity, its competitive nature, the general contractor market, all those things that we look at in terms of approaching a market, but then we also have to apply what it is we're good at, what our strategic approach is to make sure that we can fit or provide value in that particular market. And that's the other half of the research that we do on market approach. We're constantly milling ideas around what we call a growth model.
One of the things we emphasize with clients is that good strategy rests on four pillars: the idea of focus, choice, systems, and the mindsets and behaviors that accompany those. And one of the biggest distinctions is between simply deciding and actually choosing. Deciding is the easy part. Choosing is the hard part. Choosing means drawing a line in the sand. It's not only what we are going to pursue, but what we're willing to walk away from. That's where a lot of leaders and a lot of organizations get stuck. And it's where my conversation with Scott Peterson, CEO of Interstates, picked up. Scott shared how they're strengthening that mindset to let go of what no longer fits so they can build what comes next. Here's my conversation with Scott.
You talked about saying goodbye to things or services or products that no longer make sense or that could be done better by somebody else, but that whole mindset of kill as much as you create. That says easy, does hard. There's a lot of firms and a lot of leaders that really struggle with giving up anything that has worked for them in the past. So maybe if you could talk for a second about kind of how you all have adopted that mindset to be able to part with those things that no longer, based on the data or intuition, don't make sense anymore.
Yeah, I'd probably say we're average right now. And I want us to be way above average. I want us to be exceptional in the next 3 years. One of the things that we're exploring, and this goes back to thinking about strategy, thinking about the future. There's some information out there about you can have first generation thinking, second generation, third generation. First generation, they don't have much. They bet it all. They're very innovative. They're very bold. They're taking chances. Second generation have seen how hard that is, and they end up protecting that. They don't want to take chances. Third generation, they said, this is the way it's always been. They're almost entitled that it's not that big a struggle from that side of it. And that's when you can get happy, fat, and lazy from that side of it. So one of the things we're starting to integrate, and we've started this just probably the last year when we've been working more on with the executive team, is thinking about it from which generation are we going to be in? We have to be purposeful at times. We have to think like first generation. So what are we going to boldly create? What are we going to boldly destroy in order to create something new from that side of it? So from that mentality, we're going to be experimenting on that. Our first one, which we didn't actually use that methodology when we actually made the decision, but one of our strategic themes is in the industrial model. We have to industrialize the construction process in order to be more productive, to have higher quality, to have higher safety, to help our clients as much as we can. That means we have to standardize products. We have to do design decisions earlier so we can leverage mods. We have to do all these things earlier, and we have to change how we're actually doing our work. How many of our people and even the whole industry is basically doing the same thing we did back in the 2000s and the 90s and maybe even in the 80s. We've just made it look pretty with more technology and all that, but we haven't substantially changed how we do our work. We have to change how we do our work moving forward. That's the only, we have to let go of those standards. We have to let go of those things that gave us a lot of kudos for how smart we are, how creative we are, all those types. We have to let go of that and do something we've never done before, which is scary. And that's where the resistance comes into play. So for killing stuff, what we want to do is more, you don't kill for kill's sake. And I think that's where a lot of the old mentality comes from. It's really, you're trying to recreate, reimagine, and you just happen to have to kill something in order to get there. That's probably the more appropriate way to look at it. Otherwise, you end up just doing some hodgepodge that doesn't necessarily help the system a whole lot or the processes in order to create value for your clients. Whether it's true or not, I kind of looked at it when we went from the one company to the business units. we killed being a one company. When we went from the three business units back to one company, we killed the three business units. That's kind of, we had to let go. There's a lot of attachment and a lot of pushback saying, we're successful. I mean, we did this at a peak of how successful we were in growing and profitability and all that, and you're changing everything. Are you trying to destroy interstates? Those are some of the things that I heard when we were going through that. And that's when you're hearing that, you can't listen to it. You take it as it's a signal that they're maybe nervous, they're scared, they don't understand. So you just have to lean into a little bit more. Don't take what they're saying verbatim of what they're really saying. You got to take it more of a signal. Otherwise, you're just going to be chasing your tail all over the place. I think that's one thing that's going to be, I think every company could really benefit, is we have to do things differently in order to get different results.
If you've ever tried to implement a new strategy, the real challenge isn't the plan. It's the resistance that shows up the moment you try to change how the work actually gets done. Every company has its own version of organizational antibodies, those forces that quietly pull you back to the status quo. In my conversation with Bob Euler, retired former CEO and chairman of MWH Global, and Gary Sanderson, behavioral science guru, we talked about how leaders can overcome that resistance and create an environment where change becomes possible. Here's their take.
When you talk about strategy, it has a lot to do with differentiation and creating a value that clients want to pay for. And hopefully, it's an ever-increasing value. The evolution of change threatens the status quo, and people who don't own the initiative doubt whether it'll either work, or if it does work, how it influences them, or do they lose control over what they want to stay in control of? So it's really quite challenging. I've seen two or three models, one where companies decide they want to do something and decide it's too hard to do internally, so they acquire something, bolt it on, and then integrate. And another one is to self-start an initiative. That's extremely hard, and there's two forms of that. One is inside the company, and one is a set aside outside the company, where you let it nurture it as an embryonic play and let it get to a size before you reintegrate it into the company.
I think in one of our previous conversations, we talked about this concept of organizational antibodies. And so, Gary, maybe as a segue to you, I'd love you to kind of pick up on that same question, this notion of overcoming internal resistance to change.
I spent what nearly 5 years with Bob in the US, and this was, I think, the biggest challenge and frustration was, how do you influence a set of people to move and change their behavior to align with the strategy? And I think that probably my biggest learning over that period was it was all about an influence process. So when I returned to the UK, sharing Bob's frustration and interest in the human behavioral psychological aspects of this, I took a degree in behavioral science, and that actually revealed, I think, a number of aspects which sort of validate the problem and the nature of the problem, which is that change is implicitly resisted. No matter the change that looks at surface level like a very positive, logical, rational, strategic way forward, we have a psychological reaction because it's change, and we are threatened by change because the status quo has kept us alive and successful to date. So the big learning I've had since, I think, is that it's less about fighting to change the people and more about changing the environment in which those people operate. Sometimes you need to change the people, of course, but generally, there's a great quote. I can't remember who said it. You can get anything done in this organization as long as it's not your idea. So the gold standard of change is that people are just influenced by the environment to do what's in their best interests, or in the best interests of the company, as in aligning with its strategy. And so that behavioral science has been the big area that's unlocked a whole raft of different perspectives, particularly as I look back on the work I did with Bob and what we did together, and why some things work really well, and others maybe we found more challenging. So there's probably a couple of things just at the heart. One is the narrative. So that the emotional connection between the strategic vision and the execution has to be some sort of narrative. And every time Bob was in the room, that emotional connection was really strong. Of course, it becomes more challenging to translate that across an organization without the leader in the room all the time. And the second thing is seeking to change the environment and the things that wrap around people so that they're influenced to do the behaviors that align with the strategy and nudge them away from the traditional, the conventional, the status quo.
As leaders, one of the biggest challenges we face is keeping pace with change and bringing our organizations along with us. In a previous conversation, Brian Skipper from Hensel Phelps captured this perfectly when he said that right now, today, the speed of change is as slow as it's ever going to be, and technology is as dumb as it's ever going to be. That mindset underscores the strategic tension between being forward-leaning and staying grounded in what truly drives impact. So I asked Brian how Hensel Phelps is navigating that balance today. Here's his perspective.
I want to go back to something we talked about in our last conversation that you said that really stuck with me, which is that the speed of change is as slow as it's ever going to be today, and that technology is as dumb as it's ever going to be today. I'm curious how you see that playing out at Hensel Phelps today.
Yeah, so as a large general contractor, nationwide focused, with people coming into the market and looking at where we're trying to go, technology is at the forefront of everything that we're doing on a daily basis. We're trying to innovate. We're trying to be more efficient. We're also trying to make sure we're not too leading edge. For us, we're trying to figure out when we adopt and how we adopt. Our biggest things is our frontline individuals and how can they accept the technology we're bringing to them and how does it help their jobs. And so for us, we're trying to make sure we're doing it smartly, but we're also making sure we're communicating wisely to everyone that it's not going to slow down. So either we get part of this train or we're going to get left behind. And so we have a lot of systems in place to strategically roll out technology and to make sure it's as efficient as possible that we started craft the last couple of years. But yeah, I mean, it's at the forefront of everything. If you don't wake up in the morning and say the word AI three times when you get out of the shower, it just comes at you just at all places and everything you do. We're not misaligned to that. Construction's a little lagging compared to other industries. But overall, if you're not paying attention to it right now, in a couple of years, you're going to be left behind.
You just talked about being leading edge. So I'm curious, how do you kind of walk that fine line between leading edge and not falling off the edge?
It's tough. It's really tough. I mean, especially you have innovators in an organization like ours, people join a company to innovate. For us, where we look at is where the moments of impact can truly happen near term and pilot it properly and do different cohorts with, honestly, other individuals in the industry that some might consider competitors, but we look at them as competimates. We have an industry technology push happening, not just a Hensel Phelps one general contractor technology push. So for us, we've even stood up other ventures within the company. And so we actually stood up a group called Diverge, and they're an innovation and venture capital arm of Hensel Phelps. We actually focus on real-time job site challenges and figure out how we can take technology and processes and kind of lead them forward. So we actually have this cohort group that's really been stood up with an innovation center now that can then pre-vet some of these technologies and come along for the ride as these new VCs and startups are coming along. And so we can make sure it's smart growth and we can pilot with them to then bring it to the industry. And then on the back end of that, we're actually bringing in other general contractors of similar standing as ours in the industry, because again, we're solving an industry problem, not a Hensel Phelps problem, of how we can deploy these technologies the right way. And so that's what we're doing today.
So you mentioned several things that I want to go deeper on. Say more, Brian, if you would, about competimates.
Rankings go up and down every year, but we're going to be a $9 billion organization this year, mainly focused within the US market space nationwide. And so we look at other firms that are of similar size in that ENR top 15 amongst different subsectors. And we bring them around the table. A lot of them have their own technology teams or technology arms that they're trying to innovate with. And so we get around and we have a round table every so often that we all invite each other around the table and we have those conversations. So I say competimates because we are in the business of trying to win and secure more work as competitors, but we're competimates because there's an industry thing going on right now to properly roll out this technology. And if all of us are supporting certain ones or understanding where the misalignment is happening and lessons learned happening along the way, it makes us all a little bit more efficient. And so that's where we try to go with that.
Predictability is one of the most important markers of a strong operations engine. And our recent project manager study underscored that point. Our research showed that when project managers are actively involved early, especially in the estimating process, their ability to hit margin targets increases dramatically. That sense of ownership shifts the entire trajectory of a project. I had the privilege of speaking with my colleagues, Greg Schottman and Nelson Newman, about what drives that level of predictability. Nelson began with findings from a study and how PM involvement shapes outcomes long before the project ever breaks ground. Here's that segment.
So one of the things that we wanted to look at is how involved are project managers in the estimating phase across the portfolio of companies that we surveyed. And one of the findings were when PMs felt like they were spending 25% or more of the estimating effort, the profit success ability to hit profit margins jumps from 55% to 78%. So just PMs feeling like they had involvement in shaping, maybe it's the assumptions, they know what's coming, they know what's on the horizon, puts them in a position where they felt way more bought in to the budget, the schedule expectations, who the client is, they just feel prepared. And so this isn't necessarily about the amount of time spent estimating, it's how involved do project managers feel in the estimating effort.
Getting their fingerprints on it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think too often PMs inherit budget schedules assumptions that they didn't have part in shaping. And what happens is they end up feeling reactive from day one.
Right, right. So Greg, let me pivot over to you now for this next question. From your perspective, what are the most critical questions operational leaders should be asking if they really want to drive greater project predictability across the enterprise?
I love the word predictability. When you think about what project managers do, they're taking this estimate, as kind of Nelson talked about, and making it and transforming it into something very real. So predictability, how do we predict the risk? How do we predict profitability? How do we predict a positive outcome for our firm? So I think some of the most important questions that we need to do as business leaders to support this kind of premise of predictability is, are we actively collaborating or just communicating? Are we just creating a series of checklists?
One of the most powerful strategic tools leaders have is the ability to learn quickly by identifying failure points early and removing them from the system. Whether it's inversion, eliminating unforced errors, or simply placing small bets and adjusting fast, that discipline separates resilient organizations from reactive ones. Chris Strickland, president of Dunn University and retired Air Force colonel, and I explored that idea in depth. He shared how thoughtful debriefing, honest reflection, and consistent communication can transform how teams perform under pressure. Here's part of that conversation.
You talk about fail fast. I know Charlie Munger talks a lot, or used to talk a lot before he passed, about just inversion and how powerful mm-hmm. it is. You know, inversion is nothing more than just thinking about failure and then engineering its removal. So all the things that would cause it to fail, go ahead and just don't do those things. You know, like Bill Belichick would talk about, more games are lost than won in the NFL. Turnovers, mistakes, mental mistakes. And so let's just build the team, build the organization, build a mindset so that we don't, in those moments, crumble. So as you're going through it and placing small bets, failing fast, you learn and you just know, okay, let's file that in the pile of let's not do that anymore.
That's right. You got to have lessons learned. We have to do that in business. Yeah. We have to do it in life. You have to learn from the lessons. Otherwise, they're a lesson experience that you're going to relearn down the road. So we did that debrief with everything we did, whether it was successful or not, right? Because most people debrief things when they don't go well. Postmortem, there's a million words for it. But they always want to do it when something doesn't achieve what they wanted. But more important to that is when you debrief wins. Because you debrief losses because you want to make sure it doesn't happen again. You want to understand why. But you debrief wins because you want to be able to sustain that, not just be lucky one time.
Exactly. So you touched on this, and I want to come back to it because I think it's pretty powerful. So starting with a blank checkbook sounds great, but most things or many things succeed because they have to operate within constraints, and it forces creativity and innovation. So how did you operate in sort of this landscape of having no constraints and basically just blank canvas?
Well, let me reframe that just a little bit. It wasn't no constraints. It was a blank checkbook. It wasn't an endless checkbook. Right? Those are two different things. And we just didn't know how to put a budget against it in the beginning because we didn't know what we were going to do. You can't budget for something you don't know what you need for the pieces or the people. So what that meant was it was an awesome opportunity with the senior leaders of this company. And we have 10 different operating companies, all of which operate with different presidents, local construction done by local people. So it's a big peer network in our company underneath the CEO, but it caused incredible teamwork because we had to over talk about everything we're going to do. because it wasn't budgeted. I had to go back to him to get money for things to do. I had to coordinate with the other leaders to talk to their teams as we move forward. And it was a level of communication I don't think had been experienced before. And that was the beauty of it, because we made time to get together and talk about what difference we wanted to make, what we wanted to change, and what we wanted to be down the road. So one of the first things we looked at, this was, you know, I came on board when hiring was hard and we couldn't fill seats everywhere. And our goal was not to recruit better. Our goal was to ensure everybody knew what an awesome company it was, what an awesome culture it was, so that people are lined up to get in the door, right? They're looking for us instead of us going to look for them. So it was both internal to build our people and also external to spread the word of our company and build our credibility out in the industry.
If you want a firm to last, you have to build succession into the rhythm of the business. The strongest companies don't wait for a transition to start thinking about leadership. They build clarity around roles, evaluate talent rigorously, and design the organization for what it will need 5 years out, 10 years out, 15 years out from now. That's the lens I brought to my conversation with FMI colleagues Jake Appleman and Matt Godwin. Jake opened by explaining why effective succession planning goes far beyond title changes and org charts and what great organizations do differently.
How should companies think about integrating succession into their culture and systems so it's not just a one-time event and it's not just viewed as we've just got to replace the CEO?
Part of that has to do with the maturity and the size of the business, the readiness for it. So many will naturally think of succession as we're purely replacing the CEO or the president. And if I figure that out, everything else will just work fine. And in many cases, we listen for it and they think about succession in terms of the lines and boxes on an organizational chart. And that happens regularly. And so sometimes we'll see clients say, well, I've got it all figured out. Here's my org chart. And I've got a name in a box and it looks nice and clean and even. But the reality is in most organizations, especially small to mid-sized firms, anybody you would pull to step into increased responsibility is a key leader already in your organization. It's your best estimator. It's your best project manager. It's your best engineer. It's the person who's running your most profitable business unit. Those are the people who you would naturally bring up into an enterprise level leadership role. So part of that is thinking through the second, third order implications and making sure they're aware of the corresponding actions that would happen when you start moving leaders up. And then a lot of it too is having clarity around roles and responsibilities in the organization and building out a systematic approach. So the best organizations we see, they have great clarity on the roles and responsibilities. They evaluate leaders accurately. They get multiple perspectives as they evaluate leaders. If you don't have multiple perspectives, you're most likely to select a leader who looks just like you. And so you don't factor in the cycle of the business and what we need for the future. And so you end up with one leader picking another leader who looks just like them. So the great ones have clarity around their vision as an organization, they know where they want to go. They've got clarity around the types of leaders that they want, and they've got real rigor in terms of how they evaluate leaders. So it's not instinctive. They may use assessments. They may test people in key roles before they move into increased responsibility, but they've got multiple data points to evaluate people as well.
It's interesting when you think about org design and the lines and boxes that a lot of firms kind of get fixated on. Be an interesting thought experiment to go back and for companies that have grown to a relative degree, going through succession, being able to define what those roles need to look like 10 years out. If you were to take an org chart snapshot of what it looks like today, and then go back and find one from 10 years ago at that size, 15, 20 years ago, just to kind of get folks oriented to think, okay, we need to be designing this business and these roles for what it's going to be and where we're taking it. Versus where it is today, because I find you tend to play catch up when you're doing that.
That's right. It reminds me, Scott, of an example, a contractor that I worked with who it was first generation founder. And first generation founders tend to be highly entrepreneurial, as was this leader to his core, highly entrepreneurial, very charismatic, unbelievable tolerance for risk. And then when we started evaluating his successor, that was his model. And so he was looking around, he couldn't find anyone like him. And we had to have this conversation. You are one of one. There is nobody in your organization who's going to have that same level of risk tolerance and entrepreneurialism that you have. And so we had to have some really hard conversations and get his head wrapped around, you really need a systems builder and a process person and someone who's going to drive discipline for strategic planning and business planning and budgeting. And boy, that was just not very glamorous for him to look at that. And he said, that's the kind of leader I need. If you want to make this thing work, that's the kind of leader you need. It's not you.
Thank you for listening and for being part of this community. As we wrap up the season, I'm grateful you've chosen to spend your time with us and for your commitment to leading well in an industry that never stops evolving. I hope the lessons and perspectives from this year's guest help you think a little bit differently and gave you some practical ideas to carry with you into next year. Thanks again for joining us. And we'll see you again in 2026 for more insights, more great guests, and more conversations to help you run a stronger, more enduring business.